if you're the sort of person that uses bookshops and you wander down to your local bookshop, or if you're an online shopper and you go into Amazon, it works just as well, and you go to the mind, spirit and body, mind and spirit section, it won't take you long to find titles such as these: Secrets of a Dysfunctional Family, Healing a Dysfunctional Marriage, Overcoming Your Dysfunctional Childhood, Dysfunctional Relationships, Where They Come From and How to Change Them. Some of these will be Christian books, some of them will be secular books. But it's something that is focused on a lot. But of course, this is not something new. This is something that goes way back to the beginning of time. And of course, there is an extent to which every single one of us are dysfunctional, because we have sin in our lives, and to that extent we're not functioning 100% as we should be. But there we are. But families that we might say, well, that's a bit of a difficult family, we could go right the way back to the very first family, Adam and Eve, and we see them blaming each other for their own disobedience. We can see their children, the two boys, Cain, who murdered his brother Abel. We can see in the family of Noah, as the Bible very quaintly puts it, he disgraced his father by uncovering his nakedness, Ham. And we see with Lot, too, all sorts of difficulties there, with Abraham and Sarah. You remember Abraham lied about his wife, said she was his sister, because he wanted to avoid any difficulty with a local ruler. We can consider David, just moving on a bit further in our Bibles, a great king, a great warrior, great poet. But as a father and a husband, as we've been looking at in 2 Samuel over recent months, he was somewhat of a failure. His marriage to Bathsheba was based on an adulterous affair, and his son Absalom turned against him, and as his kingdom crumbled, we saw his family crumble too. So this is not something fresh and new. Nevertheless, these things are put in the Bible for a reason, not just to pad it out with interesting stories. And we're going to look this morning particularly at this family, Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and Esau, the two boys. So just a little bit earlier, we saw quite a romantic story from their point of view. It was a different culture to our own. I guess we'd all regard arranged marriages as a slightly alien sort of concept. But for them, in their culture, that was normal. And we see Abraham send his servants off to get a wife for his son Isaac. And they come back with this beautiful girl who's very willing to come back. And we've got this picture of Isaac. Couldn't find one of these, so it's not up there, I'm afraid. Of Isaac in the field waiting, and the servants come and they're bringing Rebekah. And there's a romantic joining together, and they're married, and life seems wonderful. But then, initially, there's a problem. It turns out that Rebekah can't have children, and 20 years go by, and no family. And Isaac prays to God for his wife, Rebekah, that she would have children, and his prayer is answered. And we see that two little twins come along. Now, in Genesis 25, we can read about this. So Isaac prays in verse 21 of chapter 25. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" And she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said, "There are two nations, two babies in your womb. The two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." Well, the two boys are born. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. And after this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was called Jacob, which is grasper. And Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. So Isaac was 40 when he got married, and then another 20 years went by, so he was 60 when these boys were born. We could say, well, there's the end to quite a nice little story, really. There were lots of problems prior to that, but here we are. Isaac had had a difficult upbringing with Ishmael and the family situation there, but here we are. He's married. He's finally got his two sons. Everything's looking as though it's good for the future. Now, it wasn't so long before things started to go wrong. The boys started to grow up, and we read this. Verse 27, the boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man, staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. What does that tell us? Well, a few things. First of all, it tells us something about Isaac, doesn't it? He was clearly a man who you could get to through his stomach, as they say. They loved the wild game, and Esau was the man who used to go out and catch that and bring it back for him. So he had a leaning towards Esau. Whereas Jacob, who was staying around in the tents at home, perhaps helping his mum out with things, we see as this story progresses that Rebekah was probably quite a dominant woman, actually. And the nice quiet son who stayed amongst the tents and helped her was her favourite. And so the foundation for something bad was starting to come together, which is favouritism. Terrible, terrible thing in families is favoritism, and we'll see that unfold in these coming verses. But Isaac clearly had Esau as a favorite. Rebekah clearly had Jacob as a favorite. And we see the dangers of that. We can see it later on in Jacob's life. It repeats itself when he has his own family. He has favorite wives or a favorite wife, and he has favorite sons. And those of you who know that story, it's not time to look at it now, but you'll know the pain and suffering that Jacob felt, never mind anybody else, as a result of his favoritism. So this is not the main point of this passage, but it is something that we could do well to heed. Favoritism sows all kinds of seeds that will result in very bad plants. Favoritism is a bad thing. We always joke in our family, because our girls know that we are very strong on this point. We don't have any favourites, so they try and draw us out. And then we get a message on our mobile phone that says it's your favourite daughter on the phone. So they try and draw us out on that, but we always say, every time we say the same, we don't have any favourites. And this is partly why, because it's a really destructive thing to do, and we can see the destruction come later. But actually, in this story, this first part of the story here, nobody is presented in a good light. I think very often, when we think about the story of Jacob and Esau, we think of, because we like to think this way, Esau's the bad guy, Jacob's the good guy. Is that a reasonable assessment of how we tend to think about this story if you just asked? Well, actually, nobody's presented particularly well, are they? In this story, the parents clearly have got these favourites, and there's other ways, as we'll see it unfold, that they don't present particularly good role models to their children. But Jacob's a pretty unpleasant character as well. I was thinking just the practicality of this, actually. And Matt, you won't mind if I use you as an example, but let's say, as we read on into these next few verses, and this is just a practical example of what it might be like. So Matt's home, and he's preparing some food. He does do that, doesn't he, Matt? Yeah. He's preparing Thai red curry, okay? And he's at home doing this and preparing all this food. Well, Chris, his brother, and most of us who know Chris will know he quite enjoys putting his kit car together. I think it's still not quite finished, is it yet? It's getting there. But he spends a lot of time in his garage getting this kit car together with Sarah. And so this particular day, Chris has been all day. And I think it happens, actually, doesn't it? Chris has been all day working on this kit car. And he's got so engrossed in getting the engine in that he's completely lost track of time. And about 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon, He suddenly realises he's incredibly hungry. He hasn't eaten all day. So he comes into the house, and as he walks towards the kitchen, he can smell this Thai red curry smell coming out from the kitchen, and it smells fantastic. And he walks into the kitchen, he says, "Matt, you wouldn't just give me a bowl of that Thai red curry because it smells so good." And Matt says, "Yes, if you pay me a tenner." Right? Now we think at that point, a bit harsh really, isn't it, between two brothers? But what about if Matt had said to him, "Tell you what, only if you give me your share of what's coming to you when our parents die." I don't know how much that is. But it's a lot, I'm sure, isn't it, Pauline? We just wouldn't know quite what to think, would we? We'd say, what an incredible thing to ask. And what would we expect Esau to say? Or what would we expect Chris to say in this example? We expect him to say, "Get lost and I'll go and find some food somewhere else." But he doesn't in this story. He actually says, "Oh, go on then. Go on then. I'm hungry. It's hunger that matters to me just now. What do I worry about what might happen in 30, 40, 50 years' time? It's too far away, too much to worry about. All I'm interested in is filling my stomach now. So okay, Matt, fair enough. I'll do it." And then to make it worse, Matt says, "Aha, you've got to swear to me first. I'm not taking your word for it. You've actually got to swear to say that you will give me that inheritance." So Jacob in this story, to my mind, comes out in a pretty awful light, really. He's a scheming person. I don't expect he thought of this on the moment. He'd probably been planning something like this for quite a long time. And he sees his opportunity and he goes for it. Now, the point of this story, really, is Esau's attitude to it. So Esau's attitude to it is, never mind about that. It's worth so much more than this bowl of curry. But actually, I don't really care about that. I'm just going to let that go. It's in the future. I don't need to worry about it. All I'm worried about is what's in front of me right now. So it's a really short-sighted decision, isn't it? But before we get to throw too many bricks at these two boys, let's consider how that can apply to us. So if we go to Hebrews chapter 12, we can read there where God says through the writer to the Hebrews, "Don't be like Esau. Don't be a profane person like Esau. Whatever you do, do not be like him." What does that mean? So profane person, we might think somebody who swears a lot, somebody who has a really bad lifestyle, something like that. But actually, that isn't what's meant here. Profane in this sense means somebody who had no thought for the future. Somebody who made these instant decisions. We see to it in chapter 12 and verse 16. "See that no one is sexually immoral or is godless, like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son." So how might that apply to us? There's lots of ways in our lives where we can be tempted to compromise for the sake of short-term gain. It might be money. So it might be a job and promotion opportunity where we're going to earn a lot more money, but where it means we're going to have to work every Sunday. Now, in this church, our church position is we're not Sabbatarians, so we don't hold to the view that it's wrong to work on Sundays, but we do hold to the view that it is really important that we meet together as Christians. We hear God's word. We have that opportunity to be encouraged by each other and to encourage each other too, and to hear God's word preached. Now, if we're not going to have that opportunity because we're working, that's going to be detrimental to our long-term spiritual health. But if we're tempted to think, yeah, but I could be earning a lot more money and that means I could pay off my debts and do this and that, it's very easy to fall into things like that, where we trade something temporary for something which is much more valuable in the long term. More and more and more, we're hearing stories of even Christian couples breaking up because of affairs and other relationship difficulties. And again, the typical affair is mostly about short-term excitement being traded for long-term pain, grief and suffering to a family. That's just the reality of what it is. We can so easily be drawn into those things. Something's presented to us, if you like, on a plate, and it seems like such a good idea, but actually in the long term, we're trading what's really important for something which gives us short-term pleasure, short-term gain. Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa once said at a rally, a Christian workers' conference, he said, when the white man came to Africa, he had the Bible and we had the land. Now the white man has the land, but we have the Bible. That trade, where we trade something that's really valuable for something that seems good in the short term. So the first thing we can learn from this story is, what are we willing to trade for short-term gain? Are we willing to trade our long-term future for that? People live as though eternity's short and time is forever. But we know, of course, it's the other way around, and we get it wrong so often. We live as though time's going to go on forever. Eternity is something we can worry about in the future. But the Bible's advice to us through Hebrews is, don't be like that. Don't trade something short-term, what appears to be a short-term gain, for something which will cause sadness, difficulty, and loss in the longer term. So that's the first thing. We're going to skip over chapter 26. It's very interesting, incidentally, to read chapter 26 when you get a few spare moments, because you'll see that Isaac repeats exactly the mistake his father made, Abraham, in saying that Rebecca's his sister. It's very interesting how what we do as parents so often gets copied by our children, and should make us very careful. But that's another story. I want to move into chapter 27, which is the piece that Pauline read for us. The first four verses of this says, when Isaac was old, so we've moved on quite a few years now, these boys are probably 20 or so. When Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak that he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his older son, and said to him, my son, here I am, he answered. Isaac said, I'm now an old man and don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your weapons, your quiver and bow, go out to the open country and hunt for some wild game. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my blessing before I die. Sounds okay, doesn't it? In their culture. What was Isaac doing wrong at this point in saying that? Firstly, he was clearly trying to overturn what God had said. If you remember, we read it in chapter 25, that God had said that Jacob, the younger, would actually be the leader and therefore would get the blessing. So Isaac is really saying to God, not really interested in what your thoughts are on this. I think it should be Isaac, my favourite son, who hunts me wild game. He should be the one to get the blessing, not Jacob. He just a bit of a sissy and plays amongst the tents. It should be Isaac who gets the blessing. So that's the first mistake he makes, to try to overturn what God said. He's ruled by his senses, you know, but what he just seems to be right to him. Esau's the big man who goes out and hunts the wild game. He's the obvious person. But of course, he should have seen that Esau was hopelessly unqualified to receive the blessing. Our next slide, please, Johnny. Because we've just seen he's a profane person, he's described in Hebrews chapter 12. He's somebody who doesn't think about the future. He's someone who is not tuned in to what God wants. He's just someone who'll trade something for a moment's pleasure. And then the other thing is, he clearly conspires, doesn't he? So Isaac and Esau clearly get together in private. Isaac has this little conversation with him to say, tell you what, you go out, get me some food in, I'll get this blessing, and we'll make sure that happens, rather than perhaps what Rebecca and Jacob might want. Because we're the two guys that stick together. We're kindred spirits. We'll make that happen. And he's really trying to deceive his wife and his other son. But it didn't work out, really, because Rebecca's listening at the door. Rebecca's there listening and overhearing the conversation which is taking place. You can see in verse 5, Rebecca's now was listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So this is a bit weird, isn't it? all this behaviour is a bit weird. So you've got the dad with his favourite son Esau conspiring together in a corner to do something they know the others probably won't like. And then you've got the weirdness of the wife there with a glass to the door listening in, because she probably doesn't trust either of them very much. With good reason, probably. But she's there doing that. It's not great, is it, really? But Rebecca's there, she's listening in, and she thinks, well, we're going to have to quickly come up with a plan here, because otherwise things are going to go horribly wrong from her point of view. So we see Rebecca in charge. It seems to me Rebecca's a strong person. She's quite resourceful. She's decisive. She's quite cunning. And it seems as though Isaac has long since relinquished his spiritual leadership in the family, and Rebecca's really the one calling the shots. We think about it. Who thought of the deception? It was Rebecca. Who said to Jacob, as we read on, tell you what, you go out and get some food, and I'll prepare it in the way that your dad likes it. Rebecca's the one that says, put on some goat skins. Remember we read that? Because Jacob says, bit of a flaw in this plan. Esau's all hairy. I'm all smooth. What's going to happen if my dad touches me? He's going to realise it's the wrong person. And you notice the language that Jacob uses? He says, I would appear to be deceiving him. Well, he's not appearing to deceive him, is he? He is deceiving him. But he's just trying to convince himself it's not quite as bad as he thinks. So he does that. And Rebecca's the one that says, let the blame fall on me. So she's the one very much taking control of the situation. Jacob isn't too reluctant to go along with it, is he, really? He's fairly happy to go along with it, just as long as we can cover off the kind of bits that might be difficult. He's happy because in the ends justify the means. He knows by now, I'm sure, Rebecca knows too, because God spoke to her directly, that he's the one to have the blessing. So they're thinking to themselves, probably, this is all a bit deceptive, but actually, all we're doing is carrying out God's will. God's made it very clear that Jacob is to have the blessing. So we better step in and help God out. Otherwise it's going to go wrong, because Isaac's going to do the wrong thing. Rebecca thinks I need to step in and help God out, because otherwise his plan is not going to work out properly. And Jacob is very willing to go along with it. I'm sure God will understand. We're only trying to do the right thing. We're only trying to put into practice what God has already said. And so Jacob goes off. He gets the food in. Rebecca prepares it. And he takes it in to Isaac. Look at the deception here then. So first of all, Jacob says, I am Esau, your firstborn. Not true, is it? I am Esau, your firstborn. And when Isaac queries it and says, wow, you're back quick. How did you manage to catch all that game that quickly? He says, blasphemously, the Lord your God gave me success. Totally untrue, isn't it? And attributing something to God, that God was part of this deception. And then Isaac is still a bit unsure. And he says, are you really my son, Esau? He says, I am. He's quite happy to repeat the lie, repeat that deception. Yeah, I'm Esau. And he even goes and kisses him to try to prove that. And he has the smell of the skins and things on his hands. And that deceives Isaac even more. And he says, well, I can actually smell. It does smell like my son, Esau. So all this deception is going on in this family. And then we see that the blessing, of course, is then given to Jacob. And in those days, the cultural thing was that the blessing, usually to the elder son, would be twice the amount that would go to the younger son. And the other things that we read were as Isaac blesses Jacob. And he says, may God give you of heaven's dew and of earth's richness and abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed and those who bless you be blessed. So he has the blessing. But then, of course, Esau comes running in afterwards with his food, and Isaac says, well, it's too late. I've already done it. Who was that person who came in before? The whole deception is realized. And so you've got Isaac who's trying to deceive his wife and Jacob by giving the blessing to his son Esau. You've got Jacob trying to deceive his dad by pretending to be Esau. There's deception going on all over the place in this family. And then we see what happens next. The sad bit is the family completely disintegrates. During this chapter, it's interesting to see there's not a place where it's mentioned that all four of them were together at the same time. They weren't. They appeared to be separated off. But it's about to become a lot worse, as we see in verse 27. We see verse 30. After Isaac finished blessing him and Jacob was scared, he left his father's presence. His brother Esau came in from hunting. He too had prepared some tasty food and brought it to his father. And he asked for a blessing. And of course Esau is unable to give him one. He's already done that. He can't do it twice. And we see then that Esau, in verse 41, Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. And he said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, and I'll kill my brother Jacob. When Rebekah was told what her older son Esau had said, she sent for her younger son Jacob and said to him, your brother is consoling himself with the thought of killing you. Do what I say, flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay with him for a while until your brother's fury subsides. So now we have the family completely broken up. Jacob's had to flee for his life. So we see that although Jacob got the blessing, so in a way you could say his deception worked, he got the blessing, but actually he ends up with the family being broken up. He's penniless. He's actually lost his father's possessions, what he would have had because he's no longer at home. So he's homeless. He's fleeing for his life, wondering if Esau's coming after him. His relationship with his brother is completely broken at this point, and he's humiliated his father. So he's got the blessing, but he's ended up paying a huge price for it. And we see later on, not today, we can see later on how his life unfolded after that. God blessed him, as Isaac had said, but he had paid a great price for that. And we can see later on all the difficulties that came into Jacob's life. But nevertheless, just, I don't know how long, probably no more than a day or two, after this event, when you remember Jacob, if you know the story, Jacob ran, and he keeps running, and he sets out for Haran, where his mother had told him to go. And he stopped to sleep, and he put a stone for his pillow, and he lay down, a lonely, frightened man. And he had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will bring you back to this land. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I've done what I've promised you. So the amazing thing about this is, despite that messy behavior, yet God blesses Jacob still, in spite of all that he had done. A thought just occurred to me, coming towards a close, the thought occurred to me, I wonder if this big extended family walked into Emmanuel this morning, and we saw Abraham coming in, and Isaac and Rebecca and these boys, and all of this was going on exactly as we've just been looking at. And they're here for their 3-month period. We start to get to know about all this going on in their lives, and they apply to us for membership. I'm just thinking about the elders' meeting, we're in Spencer's Lounge, and we're saying, these guys have applied for membership, what do you think we should say? I wonder. Not the kind of family we'd think of as the ideal Christian family to be joining in with us. And particularly as you go on through Jacob's life and you see some of the things that were happening there, where his wives were trading his time and his bed for plants and all sorts of weird and strange things. I wonder what we think about that. And yet, many of these people were God's friends. We know that Abraham's described as the friend of God, that his faith was counted to him for righteousness. We see that Jacob was blessed by God greatly, and in fact the nation of Israel is named after him and has been ever since. So what can we actually learn from this? First of all then, as we saw just a bit earlier, what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? So the first thing we can learn from this story is, don't trade something which is eternal for something which seems convenient or of short-term excitement. Something which just seems great for today, but you end up giving away your soul for the future. Don't be like Esau, who did that. And then secondly, those who wait on the Lord, though it's difficult, will not in the end be disappointed. So just coming back to my brief words to the children, how much better it might have been if Jacob had learned to wait. Because the thing is, Rebecca said, wow, it's all going wrong, quick, we need to get in and help God out. This is all going wrong, this is not how it's supposed to be. The thing is, God's plan, we know, can never ever be frustrated. So it would never have happened that Esau would have got the blessing. That would not have happened. We don't know in what way that would have worked out, but he would not have got the blessing. Rebecca didn't need to be helping him out. Now the last point, Johnny. Thank you. But those who impatiently try to force God's hand may get what they want, but in the process they will lose everything of value in life. So this is one that we can all take on board. We need to be patient and wait for God's plan to unfold. That doesn't mean that we just sit and do absolutely nothing. A good example of this, I guess, in our own church life here, was the sort of 5, 6, 7, 8 year search we had for a building, which we're in now. It was very frustrating at times, and we thought we had a solution, and then we discovered we didn't, and we had to wait. And we had many times where it felt very frustrating, having a lot of money in the bank, but no property to buy. But I'm sure we'd all agree, if we forced through, perhaps, one of these other things that were presented to us over that period, we wouldn't be in anywhere near as good a position as we are now. God had this building planned for us. When we actually bought it, it was considerably cheaper than when we looked at it several years earlier. And everything that goes with that. We had to be patient. We had to learn to wait. Psalm 37 sums it up very nicely. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him. And he will do this. Delight yourself, in the Lord, previous verse. He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him. And he will do this. He will make righteousness shine like the dawn, the justice of your cause like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways and when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret. It only leads to evil. For evil men will be cut off, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. So the Lord in the end is in control of our circumstances. And whatever we might be facing today, we might be tempted to try to just push on a little bit more, to give God a bit of a helping hand with whatever it is that we're facing. But we need to wait for his plan to unfold. We need to pray. We need to be constant in prayer. We need to keep committing our way to him. We're not doing something to try to force it through, which is not in God's plan. When we try to interfere, we only really mess things up. That's the lesson we can learn from this. So we need to wait. We need to trust God, be still before the Lord, listen to his voice, let God speak to us. But somebody said it's the hardest prayer that we ever pray, which is, thy will be done, O Lord. Not my will be done, but your will be done, O Lord. And if it takes longer than I think it should, still thy will be done. And if I don't understand, thy will be done. When my heart's filled with fear and I'm tempted to doubt the plan, thy will be done. And we have to ask God to forgive us for presuming to know better than he does, that whatever it costs and whatever it takes, his will is always the best way.